Hey, what's up, guys? It's your boy Days, and you're about to watch Thorin rant for about 3 hours.
When you made this site Gotfrag, right, it's too easy. I've noticed this is the same with everything in life. When you succeed or you yourself become good at something, it just seems to everyone else like, ah, oh, that guy was always going to succeed. He was always good. Everyone, like, yeah, it feels so easy to them. But the joke is, I remember when this site launched, like, at the time, there were very few sites and they all had, like, proper financial backing of things.
Stack News was huge back then.
When you started this site, like, a lot of people wondered, like, will this even get off the ground? Like, will it just be, like, you know, 6 months or a year? Will you ever get any money? No one knew will there ever be profitability. I remember in the early days, I even briefly did like one article or something for the site. That was back when everyone worked for free. Like there was no money, of course. No one would even think to ask for money because it was a community site. So when you made this site, first of all, give me a sense of like, how, like, did you have a sense of like it has to go to a certain level? It has to become some, did you ever think it would get to profitability?
No. So at the time I was running a land center. I was kind of also doing, you know, playing games, but had like part-time jobs. So I wasn't really like needing the money per se, but at the end of the day, like we had a sponsor, Recon Gamer, who was one of those early game server providers, right? I don't know if you guys remember those groups that like you literally spent money through, you know, buying a server so that your team, we spoke before about CK3 and Big Dog and Scissors and Sir Scoots had these servers. That was a big effing deal because nobody had servers back then, right? Like they were the servers and they did a good job of running them. And that made them the team leader and the basically the big dog or the, you know, to use his name, but like that made them the king. It wasn't until after that there was a whole burgeoning industry that was created around this idea of you could go to a website, spend 10 bucks or whatever it was and get a server. And that was a big deal. And that was what Recon Gamer was on the early edges of. And
right.
They literally paid for our hosting. That was the only way that site stayed up for the first 2 years was because they paid the hosting. If we'd had to pay for that hosting, no chance that site stays online because even the first CPL that I covered, it would have gone down. We had so much effing traffic. We had like millions of people visiting that site back then, a million people plus to visit the first CPL. We couldn't even keep the site online. We had a joke between me and Jason Kuhn. He would try to keep it up and I'd try to crash it with how much traffic.
Right.
And I won every CPL because there's no way he could keep it up. It was just so many people wanting, like, you were talking about before, there's no information online. You had no way of knowing how a match finished. There just wasn't anything available. And obviously Valve wasn't putting it in game. So there was no way. And CPL's website was a travesty. They just didn't care about anything online. If you didn't pay your 50 bucks to get in the front door, they could give a care about you. So at the end of the day, that's what we were doing is taking the information that was happening, you know, in that LAN environment, putting it online.
One of the things I also remember your site pioneered at Gotfrag is when I used to go in the really early days, we used to go and do audio interviews. If you remember, I'd bring out a dictaphone and we would upload it as like a WAV file. We had our own paywall and we were behind that. And then you download it and you listen, which at the time was again, like, oh my God.
That was with SK, right?
You were doing that with SK. Gamers.new. I was with the Swedish Gamers company. Basically, it was like the precursor to ESE. It was like the Scandinavian version. And at the time, that in itself was mind blowing because you actually were really listening to the real player. Now look, it'd be like an hour or two after. But the difference is, I remember on your site when you partnered with the MFAVP guys, Alchemist, people will know in the modern day, and obviously Scoots came along and he was doing that. You had the first video interviews. You guys had the first video interviews, right?
They were doing video interviews too, like shortly after that. So yeah, that was a big, big deal. I mean, the MFAVP guys would come in and make, they would just basically record the entire CPL event. And I remember them having a little bit of a scuffle with Angel over at the broadcasting rights. Because even then, Angel wanted his cut. But they're like, we're not doing this for money, dude. We're going to lose money doing this, right? So like, they walk in and they're just like recording for like, I don't even remember. It's like day and night. Like, as soon as they woke up to when they went to bed. And those guys were exhausted every night. And they were working their asses off. And they would have so much footage. Like, you could just think of like a reality TV show, how much footage they have. They don't actually air. And they'd have to go through that for like weeks, even months after an event, and then release a video. And it was as big a deal as we talked about with the player videos, because you get to see all of the behind the scenes.
Yes.
You got to see all of the player interviews that you were talking about. They'd snip out some of those, but for the most part, it was in these. And these were massively valuable. And they were only like 5-10 minutes long. Like, they weren't, I mean, some of them were longer, but they weren't that long of videos either. It's just a lot of work. And that was one of the ways that people who didn't go to the events actually had a chance to like see it, because if you weren't looking at our site, seeing the scores, if you didn't watch an HLTV, you had no sense. Like, one of the biggest areas on our site that people don't realize was the gallery pages, literally, because people would scroll through the galleries just to look through the screen, you know, pictures.
Yes.
They, what is, what does K-Sharp look like? What is, you know, Heaton look like? We don't really see him very much. All he is a name on a screen in an HLTV, you know, server. Like, what is he, right? This god of a player who's really, really good. They don't even know what he looked like. The idea now if an LCS fan is watching this and is like, well, I wouldn't even know what he looks like. Like, how, that just doesn't seem like it's possible. That's the reality. Yeah, it's just impossible for them to relate.
Because the other thing was, when you got this media aspect and Scoots came on and he was working with Gottfrag, et cetera, one area I wanted to talk about, because this is another thing. This is where you were slightly ahead of time, but also no one's really cracked this in esports. When you made the paywall, when you made the Gottfrag Prime thing, where people had like a premium service and there was specifically content created behind it. Like a famous example was obviously Bootman's playbooks, where it was like a strat book before the CPL of a certain team or whatever. Good concept, like a good, the sort of thing that a casual fan wouldn't know and wouldn't be able to pick out from the demo, right? When you first made this, the reason I say I feel like you're a bit ahead of time was, like, I know at one point it was making money, but wasn't that one of those things where it's like, wasn't it hard to like manage like how many people's subscribers? And then like the part of the problem everyone's found with paywalls is you really more in the modern day do like freemium. You need to sort of like show people some of it, otherwise they don't know what's behind the pay. That's always the catch 22, isn't it? If you put too much good stuff behind, because they aren't behind the paywall yet, they don't know that there's actually loads of really good stuff there. So give me your thoughts on this, because that was like it worked in some degrees, and some, I'm sure there were some challenges that you couldn't overcome, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think this was probably 2002, 2003 range, maybe even later than that. It was in that range that we launched that Prime subscription. And I think the main focus was for us around the idea of, like, I had done, leading up to one of the events, I want to say it was winter 2002 or 2003. This is so ancient history now, it's hard to remember. But we had done, like, basically almost like 10 days or 12 days of Christmas leading up to it. And I had written 12 playbooks for all of the different teams, the major contenders of the tournament. And I'd put it on a calendar. I remember not sleeping hardly at all that entire 2 weeks. It's just building all that content. It was so much work. And we released it all for free. And it was just overwhelming. Like, the traffic, we almost broke the site. It wasn't even CPL. We almost broke the site for those. That's how much people were really into that. Because a lot of people were trying to understand more about the game. And a lot of people weren't thinking about the game from a strategic standpoint. They were just thinking about point, shoot, click, kill, get a headshot. That's what people focused on, right? But the idea of, like, hey, I'm going to pinch a bomb site from two different angles, or I'm going to hold choke points, or I'm going to rotate based upon noise and knowledge in the game, and this player is specifically rotating and not this player, or I'm going to throw flashes here versus smokes. All this stuff feels like common knowledge now, but when you're talking about Counter-Strike in the early 2000s, only the pro players understood it. And honestly, we talked about bombs, not all the pro players understood it. Okay. So at some level, like, that's not the way people thought about a computer game.
Yes.
And so when we started breaking all this down, that became a huge factor. And then it was kind of like, okay, to be able to produce these content pieces is so much bloody time. It's taking away from other things we're doing. We need some sort of way of recouping that value. And so that's when we started to go into the Prime conversation of, like, having a actual subscription service. I would say, like, at most we got to about 4,500 subscribers was our highest level. So not huge, but 4,500 subscribers.
For that time, it's very good, though. Yeah.
Yeah. $6 or $7. And not having any servers, right? Because we didn't have ESEA. We didn't have Gamers View. We didn't have this. It was literally just to buy content.
Yeah, yeah.
So for us, that was a pretty solid number. It allowed us to, like, actually start paying a few people. Like, because at that point, you spoke of Bootman. We started paying Bootman. He was paying a couple hundred bucks, which is unheard of back then. He was paying a couple hundred bucks for every playbook article that he started doing, which we would put some of them behind the paywall, some of them not. I think the freemium model is the right way to say it, although with the playbook article, we had such a robust website with all the scores and all the traffic and demos and other things. We'd only occasionally put a playbook article not behind the paywall, largely because it was just such a hard article to write. There's so much involved in it. So, and again, one other piece that people don't really remember too is demos weren't that easy to watch. I mean, like, I imagine League of Legends fans probably, like, going, well, you know what? We don't even have demos. So what are you complaining about? But that's a separate topic, right? You're an idiot. But the separate conversation is, like, it was hard. Like, you had to queue up demos. They didn't fast forward or rewind very well.
It's not like CSGO. There wasn't the bar where you could pull. Essentially, what you had to do was watch it in real time. You could use a script to fast forward, but that's all. You couldn't rewind. So if you fucked up, you had to go back and watch again to get that round. Yeah.
The creator of SK, I think a little bit of NIP too, I forget specifically, Thorsten, He's the one one of his most famous things was a demo parser. Yes. Like that's what he was known. Like the average person knew him for the demo rewind slash whatever that he had created that literally made watching demos not complete ass. I think that's the best way to put it.
Agreed,
it was the only way. And honestly, that's like, I mean, that's a huge part of the history of Counter-Strike that people don't really know is like the invention of those things. Scorebot. I don't even know who I would wish I could give credit to the person who came up with that. Cause that was a huge invention.
Oh, big
too.
Deal. Yes.
Yeah. Like these types of things were what advanced Counter-Strike to where it was and esports in general to where it was and made things like Twitch possible. Like you don't have these things, and HLTV itself made by Valve, which was kind of a train wreck at first, but came more stable. If you don't have these things, you don't create the inherent interest in watching and engaging and following the sport the way we do now. It's just not, it doesn't exist. It doesn't. So I think there's a lot of these building blocks that people don't really remember.
Let me ask you a funny question, because you have to realize there's not many people I could ask this question of midway, because I'm just older than everyone. Who the fuck was Thorin back then? Do you remember me?
I don't think you're a whole lot different then than you are now, to be honest. Okay. You were the wildcat who'd throw in articles out that everyone was kind of like, whoa, what the f- is he talking about? Especially remember you on ESEA, because you did a lot of content for them. But yeah, I mean, I think for me, that's the biggest thing is kind of being the wildcat that came in and kind of said things that other people weren't saying. And honestly, I was running Godfrag and having to run a, you know, multi, you know, million MAU website and constantly, I wasn't able to kind of be as edgy as I would like to be. And honestly, that's some of the things that I probably envied about you the most is being able the ability to just kind of go with it and just talk about stuff. So yeah, I mean, even back then, that's how I remembered you and how I know you. So yeah, I mean, the Joker of ESEA would be the way I'd probably characterize you if somebody asked you.
I was definitely, if people don't know, I was definitely even a shit talker back then. Like, there was loads of players here. And even like when I was at ESEA, of course I was throwing barbs at Gotfrag all the time and making fun of Bootman or whatever, of course, yeah.
But to me, like, that's kind of also like earned, right? Like at some level, you do things that you earn barbs for because you just do. It's being in the space. Like, I think you recognize this as well as anybody, right? If you're doing shit in the space, you're going to make mistakes. Nobody's fucking perfect, right? You're going to make mistakes. You're going to earn it. The people who are good at just taking that and letting it go and moving on and keep doing their job and like either feed it back to you, which if they can do it, great. But if they can't, just ignore it and move on and keep doing your shit. That's the people that are going to survive and going to do well in the space. So honestly, I find it interesting to see who responds to what you do and who doesn't, because to me, sometimes the people who are best off are the ones that just kind of like let you do your thing and then move on because they got to get their other stuff done, right? They got to do their other things. And to me, that's how I felt about it. It's like, hey, sometimes I earned it. Sometimes I earned getting shit talked because, you know, we didn't cover Angel maybe as hard as we should have on that article, or we didn't talk about, you know, prize money that wasn't paid out soon enough. And we did. We just sometimes didn't talk about that because we didn't want to tear down too hard somebody who was, in a sense, making everything possible.
Yes.
And that's a delicate balance when you're literally in charge of the entire media landscape in some regards of the space. Is like, if you tear somebody down, you may tear down the entire sport you're covering. And it's a challenge. And I, to a certain extent, I wish I had done more. And I think my most, the article that I love the most, that I think I remember the most, and I love's not the right word because I love doing the playbooks and those types of things. But the one I was probably the most proud of was the whole thing about the Gary Siege thing and Noah.
We ripped off the players.
When he ripped off, we went through and got all the evidence. I knew early on something was up. It didn't make sense to me. I mean, I don't want to tear down a guy, but probably just should go for it here. But Element by neglect is probably one of the worst players in the history of, you know, pro players in the history of Counter-Strike, in my opinion. Like him and what he did with Siege was atrocious. They literally got a house, rented a house, and for basically a month did nothing but drugs and, you know, whatever things you want to say in this house and burned through, I want to say about $250,000 of other players' money. And everybody knew it. The whole community knew. We had the receipts.
Yes, it was an open secret. Yeah.
Yeah, we had the bank transfers from the league that's the tournament that sent him the money.
Oh, that was it. Because initially he was using the whole CPL angle of like, oh, they just haven't sent the money, but they actually had in this case. No, it was WEG and stuff. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it was WEG. Yes. It was World Esports Games. Yes, you're right. And I was talking to the World Esports Games guys, and they were like, hey, here's the check. Here we send you the bank transfer. We've got it. And meanwhile, Gary's saying, no, we never got the money. We didn't get it. We don't have it. I don't know what happened. It's like, no, here's the bank transfer. You got the money. Why are you not paying out your players? And he's like, you know, well, I never got it. And meanwhile, I know him and Element are in a house. I'm talking to Element and he's talking about how high he is. We know that this is happening. And it's just, I still cannot believe the whitewashing that sometimes I see about some of these things. Cause it's just like, that was one of the most excruciating things I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah,
it's wild. And to be fair, there's other examples that happened that we probably didn't cover as well. But I can't imagine there being a more high-profile example with such big names. Because at the time, Element was arguably a top five player in the world.
Oh, he was a massive profile. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yes. He was one of the best players in the world.
Yes.
Right? So the idea that that would happen, that you as the manager would take your star player and go off and just kind of chill and burn off the rest of your team's money. It was great. It was wild. I can't even explain to you how crazy that was.
This does lead me into a topic that I had in mind to talk about though, because it's sort of tangentially connected. Look, it's not the same as you say, if you talk bad on CPL, the actual fear at the time, as you say, it's like, what if they actually listen and shut the whole thing down and I've just killed esports? Like, you're right. It's not the same as just being a general media person now. Like most institutions as media, you criticize, you think you're never going to destroy that's why you can call them out. But what I want to ask is this.
Like Riot's going to close.
No, exactly.
If you give them shit, exactly. Right? Like, they've got a couple of successful games.
But I remember though, like one of the things, and this was a problem if you're an early media figure, it's because we all went from being like friends with the players when we just do an interview with them at the event and no one's going to hate you for that. But when you start giving opinions like I did and like you did on your site, if you do a player book or whatever, I remember a classic high profile example, you'll remember this, was when Tech was really good online and Elude was one of the best players in the whole league. And the problem was he went to a CPL and famously Gottfried gave him like the joke award of like, you know, like something like most overhyped player or like, you know, whatever, like worst performing. One of those ones where essentially it's like a Razzie. It's like, you know, you didn't live up to billing. And rather than just take it on the chin and be like, actually, I didn't, he got mega, like, basically, like, boycotted the site and said, like, I'll never give you a demo. He took it really personally, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we had a few of those situations. I'm going to just out him because, you know what, I don't care at this point.
Okay.
Complexity, literally, Jason Lake at one point did not like the coverage that I was giving them compared to Team 3D. And Lake flat out paid somebody to DDoS our website.
All right, fucking hell. Okay.
Yeah, flat out. We have proof that it happened. I mean, I know.
All right, okay.
I mean, I know that it happened. I never made a stink about it. The website's gone. I've sold it. It's, you know, it's ancient history. I know he did it. Like, he wasn't happy that we were covering Team 3D and they were getting more positive coverage than. And again, let's be fair here. I don't give a shit who won. I really didn't care. Like, at some level, I actually would have liked Complexity to win because it's more of a story that they win than Team 3D did.
Yes.
I didn't really care. I'm just covering the story as it is, as you know from being a journalist. Sometimes you don't have a skin in the game. You don't care.
Yes.
Right? So he wasn't happy about it. And to speak to your point before, we did, after every CPL event or after every major event, it wasn't even just CPLs because we later had, you know, WEG games. We had World East, the WES, I don't know.
WSVG.
Yeah, all those acronyms. But basically, we had all those events and we'd, after each one of them, we would do those. It's not Razzie because we had positives and we had NDP award
of course,
in there.
Yes.
It was like about 20, 25 different awards. And some of them were joking. Some weren't. We'd do screenshots of them. I remember famously we made a big deal out of Moto hiding in that one spot and it ended up catching on that it became the name, the Moto spot
there
on Inferno. So like we, some of these awards pole vaulted things that were moments at the events into mega events that then changed the way people talked about things. I mean, Elude sucked that event. And he probably did cheat his ass off beforehand because he was a West Coast, you know, West Coastish player. I think actually he was Texas, but whatever. He probably was. And you know what? Yeah, he wasn't happy about it, but he came back and played really, really well. And he earned his cred. He was a good player and had some good events, but his LAN events especially some early ones, were pretty dog shit. And he deserved to be talked about that way. And you know what? It speaks to the same point I talked to you about just a few moments ago, which is the good players and the good people ignore that stuff. And they just keep focusing on getting better because that's all they can do. If you start trying to fight with us, you're missing the point. Like, it's our job to cover and make, you know, name out of this stuff. It's not our job to, like, you know, tear you down or whatever. We're largely a reflection of yourself. We're a mirror of you. And if you play poorly, you know, it's kind of on you.
One thing as well, I always actually appreciate that you did back in the day that I think is still mega underrated in esports, which I've noticed bizarrely they're really good at in Asia. Like, Koreans are amazing at this. Is you try and do things that you come up with either a nickname for a player or you have like a witty way to say it. So yours, famously, people don't know, Midway actually was the one, as far as I know, who coined where when Sunman did that ridiculous like no scope through two walls against the Elithic, you dubbed it the shot heard around the world, which is a fucking banger name. Like, I think that's probably still remembered to this day. It's a pretty good name. We need stuff like that in esports, all right? It's not just the shot. You have to have sort of like the line. I mean, people know the classic sports where down goes Fraser. Like, you need those moments.
We had a channel, So Faking was the name of it. I don't remember where we came up with that, but we had a guy on our team, and one of the, he's a part owner of our website, Joe Hoffman, who loved to kind of just make shit up, like just to okay. do exactly what you're talking about. And so it kind of became one of those early culture things in Gotfrag where we would sit around in this channel and we'd have an article brewing and we all knew what it was about and be like, well, what's a good headline for this, right? Like, what can we come up with that's snazzy? What's, you know, what happened that was interesting? And that just kind of became the culture of our site, was that we wanted to kind of, it wasn't, back then it wasn't clickbait because you didn't have, like, Google wasn't really indexing. It's not clickbait, right? But it feels like clickbait now. If I put you in a teleporter and took you back to that, you'd be like, oh, they're just giving us a clickbait headline, right? Like,
sure.
No, it wasn't really about being clickbait. It was more about being witty and intriguing and conversational and creating something that people could remember. And I think now people are afraid of doing some of those things because it feels like we're trying to be clickbaity, when in reality, sometimes you just want to add to the story. You just want to create more, whether it be the Moto Pit or whether it be the Sunman shot or whether it be, you know, these types of moments. You want to add to that element. You want something that's there. And to a certain extent, that kind of carried over into the way I always like to broadcast, right? Because I was always broadcasting all of these events and doing all the broadcasting and play-by-play. I didn't, you know what? I always find it funny because there's this huge debate amongst you broadcasters about wanting to be on the desk and have your face on screen.
Sure.
I could have given a shit. I always wanted to be the guy doing the play-by-play because right. I love talking about the game.
Right.
I wanted to be in the game talking about the game. I could care less about a desk segment. I really could. I didn't really care about it. If I was going to do a desk segment, it better have a topic that I could debate. Because if it wasn't a topic I'd debate, I'm out of there. I'm going to go get ready for the next game because I wanted to broadcast that.
Right. Obviously, one of the really tricky periods of Gotfrag, and this is a key topic I wanted to ask you about, was the period where when CGS came along, and in North America, at least, it took over Counter-Strike, and we had all that transition of all the top 1.6 players trying to become Source players. Basically, because at the time, CGS also, they were even worse than CPL. They were really trying to make it like, we're also going to have all of our own coverage and fuck people like Gotfrag. And at the time, Gotfrag was sold to MLG, which was a rival. And there was this whole era where you did cover CGS events. I remember this. On the site and with all the media stuff, but the perception was you also worked for like a rival company, and also technically MLG wasn't really Counter-Strike back then. But what was going on in that period? Give me some thoughts on this time period. Must have been a very weird like dynamic to have.
The timing's a little off on what you're describing. All right. Think that's important. So it's all really, we're talking within months.
Yeah, of course.
But what happened largely at that time frame was CGS came to us and wanted to buy Gotfrag. They flat out were trying to acquire.
A bit like they bought the teams and stuff, yeah.
Correct. They were trying to acquire the whole space up. And we had already come off of, I mean, Angel was still around. We still had CPL trying to do some things here and there. And we had just come off of the whole, now I'm going to remember. I'm going to butcher the name. What was the failed Las Vegas event?
Oh, CXG.
CXG, thank you. I was trying to remember that. So CXG, we had just coming off of CXG. And we had, you know, this is like a half a year later. And CXG was fresh in our mind. And we had gone all, I don't want to say all in, but we had gone pretty heavy into CXG because, you know what, let's be effing honest, Angel was not good for the space being the only exclusive monopoly. We needed more sponsors, more people, more stuff in the space. He was not progressing things at all. He was kind of happy to rule his roost. And there was already rumors that he was looking for the next game, which lo and behold, he ended up doing later. he was not looking for that. He was looking for a way to get out of Counter-Strike. And Counter-Strike was still big. It's not like this was the Quake to Counter-Strike part two. This was Counter-Strike was still the kingfish, and it was there was really nothing else. He was looking to kingmake on a new game because he was afraid Valve was going to come in and start taking a cut of his money.
Right.
And he wanted out of that space. He wanted to own his own game and own in the whole chain. He wanted to be able to make the money from the game, etc. And honestly, that's a little bit of what ESL and others have done later is they want to be more involved in you know the game itself. They want to own more of a stake because, hey, we talked about it. Running events is terrible business. It doesn't make money. You got to have a way to make money somewhere else. So leading into the CGS stuff, what we ended up with was a little bit of trepidation. We weren't sure what we wanted to do. They were talking to us about acquisition. MLG then came in strong about also acquisition talks, and it kind of all fell apart. A lot of it, well, the CGS part fell apart, was because, you know, Jason Bass, I don't know if you knew that name. He worked for us as our editor in chief. He left us and went and became the CGS head editor in chief there. And there was a huge little bit of a conflict there. I don't want to drag too much in, but Jason Bass basically made a decision to leave us and go be the guy for CGS. But prior to that, though, we were covering the event, and to a certain extent, we were covering it afterwards. I was invited out to LA before CGS was really a thing, and they walked me through of the rules that they were going to do. They walked us through all of it. And I said, you know, this might work. I put big old quotes on the might, but this is really going to piss off the community. And if you don't pull this off right, it's not going to work. Like this, you're catering towards an online viewership audience that is not congruent with what the reality is. And a lot of the success that we've gotten to with the rule sets that Counter-Strike had been play tested and improved and worked through. You're basically throwing that all out the window and saying, we're going to play with 10,000 money. We're going to play with less rounds. We're going to change it. Like, it just literally, like, we don't give a shit about the last 8 to 10 years of Counter-Strike. We only care about what looks good on TV for people who honestly don't give a shit about Counter-Strike, right? Like, that's kind of what we're talking about. Like, we only care about people on who watch on DirecTV and making it a consumable product. We don't care about the 100,000 people online. And that was the first crack. And honestly, I hope between that and the Angel Munoz, you know, pushing a game painkiller that didn't work, I hope event organizers will realize that they don't control this space. At the end of the day, the more that event organizers try to control things, the more they oftentimes fall on their own face because the community is the best one. Let the community make decisions. Let the community give you suggestions. React to those. Shape it based on the reactions. And that's what should have happened. And I think that's the biggest downfall of both, you know, CGS and that whole painkiller experience was when you try to lead too aggressively, you come to a place where you almost put on, you know, earmuffs to what everybody else is trying to tell you to do. And you lose sight of what's important, which is what the community is suggesting and encouraging you to do.
Right. At this time period, to explain to people, like, the problem is there's not really like a good example. Like, I guess in the modern day, maybe people like me and Richard Lewis, because we're like media figures, but we're also like have our own profile. We're not just a byline, you know. You were one of these iconic figures back then, basically. It was you. Like, I mean, I would have used the example of Slasher, but the joke is it's so old now. Even he's not that relevant a reference. That's like 10 years old in itself.
Well, he was also a Quake guy, too.
Yeah, but he also kept all the games. What I want to ask was this, though, is this time period, though, exactly when the CGS stuff happened and then going on, Got Frank continued for many years. I remember like Jesuit was heavily in control. Then after that, Nick B came along. But this period, I remember you start to like fade out and you weren't the front and center guy, and gradually there was less me. So what was it anything to do with the CGS period? Why did you sort of transition out of being this big figure in media?
Well, largely I could argue I was burned out. That was a part of it. I had also sold the company, and one of the big initiatives that MLG had was that they wanted some of the key leadership to do stuff inside of MLG. So when you get acquired by a company, a lot of what happens when you get acquired is that the company now owns everything you do. You don't have control anymore. You don't have executive authority to say, I want to do X or I want to do Y. And so what, you know, they decided was the best value for MLG, excuse me, was to merge Gottfrag into the MLG brand. I mean, if they could have gotten away with it, they would have renamed Gottfrag to something MLG related. They believed in their brand above all else. This is why I don't think it ever even crossed their mind that killing or destroying or knocking, taking down the Gottfrag website would mean anything. Like to them, it didn't mean anything. It wasn't a loss. They didn't understand there was value there. They saw the value as being entirely inside of their own brand. So one of the things they wanted us to do, and this is what Sir Scoots, Alchemist and I all did, was we ran broadcasts and tournaments for World of Warcraft. It was huge. Like, I mean, I know this is crazy to say, and most of people don't believe it, but we were running some of the early arena tournaments for World of Warcraft.
I remember this. They actually had impossible viewership numbers. They were getting 100,000 back then, I remember. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a couple hundred thousand, actually. It was massive. We were breaking. Yes. So back then, MLG was a Halo company, right? Like, it was Halo, and they believed that they were the king of everything. We were doing Counter-Strike over here, and they thought we were little kids, right? They would thought, oh, yeah, no big deal, right? We've got massive audience. We get all these people to come. We rolled in with World of Warcraft, which I would argue at the time was even weaker than Counter-Strike, and we crushed the shit out of them. We absolutely were beating them double-figure viewership numbers. Like, our quarterfinal game would crush their quarterfinal game. It would be like 5,000 viewers on on the MLG Halo broadcast, and we'd have 70,000. And then it would just expand into the final. And it was just crazy. And so we were running this crazy, so that was kind of where we were focused. I ran that for 2 years. We got them a huge sponsorship from Dell. Lee Chin was amazing there. He was our CEO at Godfrag and had friends at Dell and was able to get us a big sponsorship there and bring that in and really helped kind of pole vault all of that in. But I did my 2 years, and honestly, I did not, like, between you and I, the guys over there at MLG, I knew it was a train wreck. And honestly, part of my sale of the company was in stock of MLG. That's about as valuable right now as the toilet paper that you've got in your bathroom. It was garbage, and I knew it was. And it was a frat boy environment. Like, you go to those events when you go to them, and they got their penthouse suite, and every one of the, you know, every one of the guys who's even associated and all the players were up there partying every night. And like, there wasn't any kind of like, hey, we're trying to build something here mentality. So, you know, 2 years in, I was gone. I was done. In retrospect, I think the biggest thing I wish that had changed about that environment, and Jason Kuhn and I say it, is we wish we would have not listened to them and just made a clone copy of Godfrag.
Yes.
The whole day.
I had to say, this is a question I want to ask.
Yeah.
You might not, shock you, but over the years, I mean, now it's more like 10 years ago, but when the site had been down for a few years, dude, you don't know how many people of us have tried to get that site again. A Slasher, I remember, contacting Jason Chen, so Scoots did. We even offered, like, look, if you can find that, we'll even buy the hard drive from you, like, just to have the data, because, like, think about all the history that's lost.
You wouldn't need to buy it from me. I would have happily put it up. I would have done anything possible to get it up. I would have loved to have had it up. But we are contractually obligated, under penalty of being sued, potentially having money clawed back from the deal, if we were holding on to that data. It was literally written in the contract. So, I mean, in retrospect, I don't think anyone would have known. Nobody would have said anything. And now with MLG largely defunct, and, you know, I guess it's part ownership of, or owned in Blizzard, or by extension Microsoft's IP somewhere. But the reality is, like, it's, nobody would have cared. And you just don't know that. Like, again, I wasn't young, but I was in my 20s, right? Like, how do you know you have a contract that says, hey, you cannot keep this? You know, who's going to, like, you just paid me a fairly nice check to, like, buy this site from
me. Yeah, you'd think they would value it. Exactly. By the way, the reason I ask, though, is because I always thought the thing that must suck is, look, it's the same for most of the sites I work for, mate. Like, if I tell someone I work for the site, when someone watches this interview, they can't go on sitegotfrag.com and see it all. Like, they could, maybe they could go on the archive.org and there'll be a few pages, but it's not the same. Like, it's kind of whack that you can't point to it and go, look, I did that.
Yeah, I mean, I only have a handful of articles that I've saved on my hard drive and a couple of things, but to your point, like, I have probably eight plus years, maybe even closer to 10 years worth of content that I've written and things that I've done that are honestly some of the best work I've ever done. Like, I could have taken much of that and probably gotten a job for, like, the New York Times or some major media organization. I don't have it now. I can't do that. And again, it's not what I want to do. So it's not that big a deal, but at the end of the day, like, it sucked. And I honestly, I'm more pissed off though, because I think the stats for some of these players,
that's really tragic as well. Yes,
it is more tragic.
Yes.
Like, I mean, my content, I wish I had, but the players, this is some of that stuff is their effing careers.
Agreed.
We speak of Elude, right? We talk about how good he is. You and I are the only ones who, I mean, not you and I, but like a handful of us are really the only ones who know those demos, all of the stats that he posted, all of the stuff that was done. Nobody has any record of that stuff anymore. It, it's I can't even like, it's heartbreaking to even relive some of that.
Right. As you said, you were like burned out and stuff. If people don't know, it's not like that's where the story stops. Then today I'm interviewing you. You also worked basically throughout all of CSGO pretty much, but behind the scenes. So you worked for ESL and you're mainly on the North America side. I remember also that you were with the Nota Buff people as well. Like, what's the vibe? Did you just want to have like just an industry job? Have you ever thought about doing anything public again?
Well, so a couple of things happened. I took the 2 years off mandatory. So when I left MLG, I had a 2-year non-compete. I wasn't allowed to be in esports at all. It was ironclad in my contract. You know, they didn't want me going out and restarting Godfried, basically. So I had to take a 2-year break. Around the end of that 2-year break, I started working with Jason Kuhn again, the guy who I'd originally done Godfried with, and we wanted to do stat stuff. So we actually started in League of Legends. We had created a whole League of Legends site. We were created Elo Buff. I don't know.
All right. Yeah. That was quite famous back in the day. Yeah.
Yeah. We created all the stats behind the scene for all of the pro games and some of the pro players. We had a subscription service over there that had about 5,000-6,000 subscribers. CLG was our big sponsor back then, really pumping us up. So we basically, running stats early days for League of Legends. We didn't transition because that made a whole transition into like the public stats systems where you had like, it later became op.gg, but yes. You had a lot of the, early stats sites on the internet that were free. We didn't really make that transition because we had been approached at the time by the guy who was like the lone person doing Dota stuff, Dota stats. And he was like, I can't run this site. I need somebody to do this. And we're like, okay, do we want to fight to be one amongst 100 Dota site, or excuse me, League of Legends sites, or be the only Dota site? And it was like, well, let's go see what we can do with Dota. And we created Dota Buff, and it's, it is the big site. It is the stat site for Dota and has been for, God, as long as I can remember now. It's basically since Dota 2 came out. And yeah, we have multiple million, like 3-4 million people who visit that site every month. It is the definitive site for Dota. And the largest community site. And we've been running it ever since. It's been an amazing property. We also have Overbuff. We also have Valor Buff, which is a smaller site. And we have a couple of other, smaller sites. And then we acquired just recently speedrun.com, which does all of the data and all of the tracking for all of the fastest runs for most of the single player games that you could come up with. All of the Minecraft games, all of the different Roblox games, your latest game that comes out for Super Mario Brothers or all those, people go on there and then they post their runs and people, if you ever want to do like a deep dive into, you get those deep dives on the internet where you like go into something and you get lost, go on to speedrun.com and go find some of these categories of things that you've played in the past and just be blown away by how fast some of these guys can do these things, because every single run has a video. So you can watch these people do it and you're just like, what the hell? Like, I can't even think of some of these really long games that takes like,
there's somewhere famously you can do some like in the spawn, like you could go over a wall and like you're halfway through the level and stuff. There's like really mental ones that you'll never believe. Exactly.
I do think like at some point in the future, and this is just a belief of mine, but at some point in the future, we're going to see speedrunning become like the track and field of esports. Okay. I do think that there is a lot of like, we're going to see that kind of evolve. We're going to see that grow. We already see that with a lot of the big events that happen now. A lot of them are like charity level events. But at some GDQ, for example, like some of these things are already starting to get there. But I do think at some level, we're going to see this grow into a bigger and bigger thing that is kind of, it's not going to be bigger than Counter-Strike. I think multiplayer based, we skipped over that a little bit when we were talking about the Quake to Counter-Strike thing. But I'm a big believer in team-based games is always more competitively enjoying and viewership, interesting than traditional 1v1s. But if I'm going to watch a 1v1, I'm not going to watch a Quake. Sorry. One versus one on a server just isn't that compelling to me. But seeing a person up against a time clock, seeing a person having to beat something and having other people doing it also at the same time, that's interesting to me, right? So watching like five guys all trying to break a Super Mario Brothers record or be the fastest one, who's going to screw up first? That's compelling. That's interesting. And I think there's something there that we haven't quite tapped into yet that I think has a potential in the future and could be pretty big deal.
Since, as you say, a lot of the old school stuff is just lost to history or it's just memories in people's mind, I thought at the end a cool angle would be, give me a player or a couple if you want. Who's some players back in the day that Midway always thought were underrated? Like, these guys were good, but they never got their shine or they never got, like, the true credit of how good they were. Is there a couple that come to mind?
Oh, man. You're really asking me to dive deep. So I think if we start thinking about like players who were on teams, nobody's like jumping out to my mind at the moment, which is kind of, I should have come more prepped on this answer.
Is it, I caught you off guard?
No. I feel like I'm doing injustice to a lot of people because there's a lot of names that I could jump on. You know, a player, it's going to sound really weird because he's not really underrated, but he kind of just took a different career. Have you watched the World Cup?
Yeah.
Do you know Stude Holden?
Oh, I know this story. He became a professional football player. Yeah. He only did a couple of years as pro, yeah.
He was really fucking good at Counter-Strike. He was.
If people don't know, this guy actually played for the real men's United States team in World Cups, etc. Yeah.
Yeah, and he now broadcasts the World Cup.
Yeah, he's like the main guy in America, right?
He was on Forsaken's team, which was a Counter-Strike team back in the day, and they were really fucking good. And he was surrounded by like three guys who we knew cheated. And we all thought maybe he cheated. But then he went to an actual LAN event and was by far their best player. It wasn't even fucking close. Like, he was just lighting up the server, yes. And everybody was like, who the fuck is this guy, right? Because he had just been another guy online around three other guys. And then all of a sudden, he shows up to the LAN event, and he's carrying their team, and they're getting absolutely blasted by some European team. I don't even remember now. And he's the only guy who even looked like he belonged in the server with them. And, yeah, I mean, that one jumps in mind because
that's a good show. Here's the thing. He's not as well remembered as you believe. Like, I've pointed that out as a piece of trivia when he was famous in football. If people don't know, if you watch the American broadcast, literally him and fucking Steve Nash are like the 1-2 duo, like Steve Nash from the NBA. Like, it's great. It's one of those ones where he really is somebody who just got out of esports and just went higher, just went further.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine during his esports time, he was also doing soccer, you know,
he
like,
was,
of course,
yes, on the side.
He's probably playing soccer like 24/7, but like, his ability in esports was insane. Like, he was really fucking good. So, yeah, I mean,
that's a good pull.
That's just a random one, but because the World Cup is like probably on as we're talking, like that just totally came to my mind. It's like, yeah, he was a really fucking good player, and he was really quite compelling. The challenge for me is I knew a lot of these players online, and I think a lot of them were really, really good. But then, like, again, I'm not trying to throw shade, but like, breaking them down and saying LAN versus reality, it's really, really hard. Destruct is another really good name that people don't remember. He was more of a 1v1 player, but his Counter-Strike skill was really fucking good.
Yes.
I'm trying to remember who was a lot of these guys from the East Coast were a lot better than people gave them credit for. And I'm trying to remember some of those names. Wombat was a really fucking good player. I don't know if you remember him from the Quake days.
Yeah, yeah. He played in very early Counter-Strike, yeah.
He was playing in Counter-Strike for the first 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, yeah.
He was really fucking good.
He was on the RDW team with Destructive, whatever, yeah.
We always joke about, you know, some of the other names, some of the big names who tried to play Counter-Strike and didn't, or, you know, from the Quake days, who didn't really play very well, if you get where I'm going with that statement. But Wombat was one that, honestly, he looked like a natural playing Counter-Strike.
Right.
He played Counter-Strike the way other pro players did. He communicated well. He organized. He structured. I played a lot of pugs with him back in the day. He was a good player. He was a really good player who was also capable of making that shift. And he was good in his own right in Quake, right? Like, he was good and great in Quake, also great in Counter-Strike. So another big pull for you there as well.
At the end of this interview, do you have a final message for people, or do you want to thank someone or shout them out?
Well, maybe one thing I want to hit at you before you get off, because I don't think people knew this one as well. When I first joined ESL, and I talked about my joining of ELO and creating of Dota Buff and all that. But when I first joined, and this was like a few months or maybe 6 months after I started ELO and started doing Dota Buff stuff and ELO Buff, I joined ESL. One of the first things I did was help create the LCS. Like, I created the first league for League of Legends. You know, so all Reginald and all these guys were talking to me about organizing and structuring and doing their matches. And I was right in the middle of all of the conversations between all of these teams and the streamers, because back then, I don't know if you probably remember, but there was this huge war between Twitch and OG
on 3D.
Own3D, thank you. A huge war between Own3D and Twitch over the ownership of the future. And back then, it wasn't a certainty that this
And there was massive amounts of money getting thrown back. Yeah, exactly.
There wasn't this like known fact that this Justin TV fools were going to turn into Twitch that was going to turn into what it is now that's owned by Amazon. Back then, Own3D owned the space, literally. Yes. It owned that space. And the early LCS and League of Legends, you know, that was what we were running. We were running the first league before it was called LCS. And it was interesting. Like, I mean, we were working with them to help build the league. And largely they made the decision that they saw enough potential in what was happening and where it was going that they wanted to own it all internally. And
that's just a piece of trivia.
And they made the decision early on. They couldn't do it in Europe. So ESL ran the first, like, I want to say 3 to 4 seasons of LCS or the European league.
Yes. Used to just be in the ESL office, I remember.
Yeah. And so they ran the first few seasons, but they took it over right from the start from North America from us. And we had run 2 or 3 seasons before that. It's gone to the dustbin of history. But yeah, we ran all of those seasons and all of that stuff. And we were in charge of, by the way, all the stuff that you talk about with some of these pro, you know, owners, like I have so many stories of like dealing with these guys, like, nothing that comes out about Reginald and all of the stuff that comes out about TSM, none of that's a surprise. Like, I could have told you that before LCS even started. I knew all that was, you know, all of the personality, all of that stuff. He was just as hard to work with back then as he is, you know, as he has become in regards.
What about some final words to wrap up?
I'm happy to talk about all this stuff. Love to come back and talk some more if you got it. I enjoy kind of, as you can see, and balancing of life between family and esports. I think to me, that's one thing I would say for all of the people who follow this and have kind of made it this far in the video. One thing I encourage all of you is just to balance life. It's not, you know, at the end of the day, esports and all of this is valuable and we love it and it's what we do. But having a family, having kids, you know, having another part of it, that's important too. It's about being a well-rounded person too. So to me, I found myself a lot of times in the dark days eating too much fast food, spending too much time traveling to events and not enough time having someone to share it with. I have one funny story to kind of end you with is I had a 6 or 7 straight years going to France, to Paris for
SWC.
Esports World Cup.
Yeah.
The 6th time I went, I got so tired of being in Paris that I just decided I was going to go see every exhibit in the Louvre. And I spent like 6 hours in the Louvre. I had nothing else to do, So sometimes it's just nice to have people to share your life with. So I encourage all of you to keep balance, keep that in retrospect, because sometimes it's just, you want to bring somebody along with you and share your life with. And, you know, just keeping focused on one thing can oftentimes be a real, real big burnout for you.
Money doesn't grow on trees, and believe it or not, just watching a video for free with your dad doesn't really pay the bills. So thanks to the following people for kindly supporting my work and this particular content. And those people are, of course, Ahmed Hajou, Matt Pugnaccio Rakula, Animosity, ButPounder420, Jensen Gore, Kovacevic, Tobias Bernasconi, Tosh, Toucan, and a special thanks always goes out to Jerky's Minion, my main man. You know what? There are plenty of perks to be found on my Patreon, like you can find out who upcoming guests are for my reflections, interviews and talk shows. You can ask me a question in my monthly AMA. Might get roasted if it's a bit spicy in how you phrase it. You can figure out which pieces of content I might want to do next. I often ask people which they think between certain ideas, offer suggestions. You can even take part in one of those long discussions with me about all kinds of esports, whatever's on your mind. So if any of those sound like something that takes your fancy, put your money where your mouth is. Join the Scrumanati today via the Patreon link in the description below.